But I'm going to just introduce Dr. Evan Cantor, MD, PhD. He's a staff psychiatrist at the Veterans Administration Puget Sound Healthcare System. He's also a clinical assistant professor, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, the University of Washington School of Medicine. Evan serves on the board of directors for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Dr. Cantor specializes in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, and has written in here he is a member of Veterans for Peace, the Seattle chapter, chapter 92. Dr. Cantor.
This workshop is about finding your way home. And I recently saw an Iraq veteran who was a Humvee driver over there. And like many Humvee drivers, he's having a lot of difficulty navigating Interstate 5, because if there's anything like a cardboard box or anything unusual on the side of the road that could be an IED, it causes him to swerve across lanes or have to stop his car and check it out. He had an argument with his wife in the middle of a supermarket aisle, and the wife yelled at him, "What's the matter with you? You've been home for a year." And he told her, "When I don't have to react to a cardboard box on the side of the road, then I'll feel like I'm home." Today, we have two psychologists who are outstanding therapists. And I think for the sake of time, I'll let them introduce themselves. One of the main differences between the situation today and the situation 30 years ago when our veterans came back from Vietnam is that we know a lot more about post-traumatic stress, about readjustment. We have treatments that are effective, and we can help in ways that we couldn't then. And so we have two outstanding therapists today who are going to tell you about what we can do to help people come home. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Bridget Cantrell, and I'm very honored to be here with you today. And I am a contractor with the Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs PTSD program, one of 28 counselors in the state of Washington. And we go around the state and we provide services to families and veterans who have served either active duty, they can be out of the military or whatnot, but as long as they're affiliated with service in the military, we can provide services to them and to their family members. So that is a very wonderful service that we're able to provide, and it's outside of the VA system, which for some is a much easier avenue to get some help, depending on where they're located in the state and how close they're located to a medical facility. I wrote the book Downrange to Iraq and Back with my co-author Chuck Dean, who's a Vietnam veteran, and we collaborated. We used his combat experience and his adjustment issues and my clinical experience and myself being the daughter of a World War II Korean War veteran who has post-traumatic stress disorder. We used those conditions and we wrote a book together, and it's specifically written for the troops and their families to help them understand that there are major implications associated with going off to combat and the adjustment issues that are faced by each and every person, even not only just the veteran but their family members. And so it's very important that we join hands in all avenues, whether it's community group organizations, churches, veterans, vet centers, VA hospitals, therapists, or whatnot in the community. It's very, very important that we all come together and collaborate so we can provide services to those soldiers coming home. And I use the term soldiers just because it's easier than designating Marine, Airman, Sailor, but National Guard. So I work with the troops directly, And what I am seeing is I'm seeing just what Dr. Cantor was indicating, that they're having a lot of trouble readjusting to coming home. They're fighting their war in an urban setting, and they're coming home to an urban setting. So there's so many triggers that we don't even think about that are situations that activate their post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know that the military is now referring to it as combat operational stress, because not everyone that goes off to combat actually gets a full-blown diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, but it certainly is a diagnosis that we have to pay attention to. Everyone's going to be affected. No one's going to come home unscathed. So I'm seeing a lot of the problems on the highways, the road rage, the anger, the domestic violence. It's very, very prominent, the anger. You know, when they're in a combat zone, they operate from the perspective of being a primal function. That's testosterone. That's aggression. And there's no thought. You cannot stop and think. In their training, they're trained well to do what they have to do. And they're trained stimulus response. There's no thinking involved. And so when they come home and they're having to reintegrate back into our families and back into the communities, they don't stop for a moment to think before they respond. It's automatic. They're on autopilot. And so when we do our therapy, we're trying to help them pull apart that stimulus response pattern that's so deeply ingrained in them. We're trying to help them know that there's a stimulus and eventually over time realize what their triggers are so that they're not so activated for such a long period of time. I mean, there's World War II vets that are still having nightmares, who are still kicking their wives out of bed. I mean, this doesn't go away, but it does get better over time if they get treatment. And there are statistics that indicate that if someone gets treatment early on, that their symptoms reduce from a period of 64 months of real high activation and stimulation to 32 months. So if we can get to them soon enough, we can have a good possibility of changing their response patterns and changing that internal activation that they're feeling. You know, so many guys are telling me, Bridget, I just feel like I'm crawling out of my skin. I can't stand it. So anger is certainly a big deal, and the nightmares are very prominent. And I know that now we're giving them some medication, prazosin or prazosin, I don't know, however you say it. Different camps say it different ways. And it is actually started at the university or the VA Medical Center with Dr. Murray Raskins, and it's a medication that reduces blood pressure, and it's been real effective with a lot of veterans in reducing their nightmares. So, and I know that they're using some other medications right now. I've been reading to deactivate some of the memories and that type of thing. So this war is, of course, there's certain traits with all wars that go without saying, but this war is unique in the fact that there is the ability to extract the wounded much quicker. There's the ability to get them to a medical field hospitals much quicker. The people that are within the units, from what I understand, are trained to give medical treatment. So the survival rate is much higher for those who have been wounded. The wounds are very grave, many of them, but they're surviving. And so we're going to have these young men and women coming back into our communities. And I really want to stress the fact that we have to forget the fact that, you know, sure, they have gone off to war, but we're talking about the souls of these young people. And some of them are not so young either. Some of them are in their 50s. And we're talking about the souls of these young people who are coming home and who have been wounded in their souls. And it's our obligation as a community to bring them back home. And that means we support them. We don't judge them for what they've done. It's not their fault. It's just like the Vietnam veterans. Hopefully we've learned from the Vietnam veterans. They were very shunned by the community that they came home to. And many of them have felt that they never did come home, that they left their men, and that's where their home was. And so hopefully we as a community will learn that we must be able to provide whatever's needed on a grassroots level to help welcome our troops home and forget what our own agendas are, but just know that we're dealing with a person that's been very wounded internally. I'm sure most of you all know about the implications of post-traumatic stress or combat-related stress. It's very difficult for them to have relationships. The divorce rate is very high right now. Oh my gosh. It's very difficult for them to come home. And I was supposed to turn my phone off and I didn't. I'm so sorry. But they have multiple relationships. It's very hard for them to feel comfortable and feel like they've come home. So it's part of the process of bringing them back home is helping the wives and their families understand what they've gone through. And of course, we'll never understand. Not even as clinicians will we ever understand. That's an impossibility because we've never walked in their boots. So that's a big thing is the relationships. So if we can inform the communities, the families, help them understand how their troop that's returning is going to be affected, they're going to feel like they can't get close. I always talk about a perimeter wire that they put up right in front of their hearts. In order to survive what they've survived over in a combat zone, they have to freeze their hearts. They can't feel. They can't feel all the emotional pain and whatnot, or they're not going to survive. And so their main objective over there is to survive and bring their buddy back alive. And in order to do that, they have to do certain things in order to ready themselves for that particular experience. And so when they come home, they can't just all of a sudden feel like they can become intimate again and start feeling joy and happiness and closeness because they're still in the mindset of having gone off to combat. Multiple jobs, we're going to see them coming back into the job market. And hopefully those of you who do the hiring are going to have more awareness that this is an Iraqi vet coming home or this is a Vietnam vet or whatnot. I mean, just be aware and ask them if there's something particular they need. They may not need to they don't want to be the focus of attention, but they certainly may need to have maybe extra breaks. Their anger gets activated. They need to know it's okay to take care of themselves and to walk outside. Maybe if they work inside a building, they can be in an area where there's not people walking around them and there's not overstimulation. So we're going to see them coming back into the communities, and we have to be prepared for this. And this particular this particular war is also affecting not only the wives but the children. Where many of them have small children, and they're coming back to children that may not even recognize them. They may not even know them because the fact is that they went over when their babies were little, and now there's this parent that's come back. Or they may have sent them over, and they come home, and they're a changed person. So they're not the same mom or dad that they sent over. So the children are going through trauma. And so the whole family system is involved. So we're seeing the nightmares, we're seeing anger, we're seeing problems with communication, we're seeing problems in the workforce, in the educational systems. You know, when they first come home, many of them think that they'll come home and get right back into the swing of things. They'll start their relationships over, they'll start going back into the workforce and getting on with life. And what we're finding, like Evan pointed out, this young man had been home a year. Well, we're finding out that a few months after they get home is when the wheels start coming off. And they start getting angry with themselves because they're not able to get back into their job. They're not able to communicate with their wife. They're not able to be close to their children. And so they get angry. They go, what is wrong with me? You know, what is my problem? And I get to see them when they're like that too. And that's part of the process, a part of understanding that they have been changed. It's very hard for them to accept that they have been changed. Some of the things like just hearing examples, one of my young men said that he was really afraid to go to a barbecue, that these people were going to have a barbecue for him. He was very, very frightened of that. Now, most of you in this room would think, well, that's really great. They're going to have a party. They're going to welcome him home and have a barbecue. Well, for him, that was a trigger. That reminded him of some of the smells that he had over in Iraq. And so he was afraid of smelling the chicken or whatever it was on the barbecue. He was afraid he would go into a flashback and embarrass himself or embarrass whoever he was with. So I asked him to help himself by having someone go with him. and try to be a second set of eyes. And that's the job of all of us who are closely related to these young people that are coming home. The other thing is they're very susceptible to depression and drug and alcohol abuse. That's a way of self-medicating in order to get sleep or forget some of the memories. So we also have to be very aware of that. So, and another thing is the suicide. That's something that we really need to be aware of. So we who are around these people who are coming home, we need to be aware that if we see behaviors like they're really withdrawing a lot, they're going to withdraw a bit. You know, that's normal stuff. And a lot of the traits of post-traumatic stress are normal. It's when they become problematic that we have to be aware of that. So let's say they're really withdrawing, and let's say they're giving away their items, or they're saying things like, well, you know what, it doesn't matter anyway. You know, I don't matter. You know, things like that of just giving up, the sense of hopelessness. We need to really take heed and be very, very aware of that. And one of the things, I go around the country and I talk a lot to families and military units, and some of the mothers are very concerned about, well, how do I handle this, you know? And I say, you know, they probably aren't going to listen to you, but you could call a buddy, someone they served with or another veteran. And what I've been doing in my practice is I've been getting my Vietnam vets and even Korean War vets, who is ever available, to collaborate with these troops that are coming home, because they're seeking veterans out, because you know what it's like. And that's a really wonderful thing to do. It gives the veterans who have served before that may have not thought that their war, well, they may have thought their war was in vain, it gives them a reason and a purpose. Now they can use their wisdom to help bring our troops home and participate with them and just be a phone call away if they need some support or help. And that's a lot different than it was for the Vietnam veterans, of course. There's a lot of health issues associated with post-traumatic stress, diabetes, heart disease. Of course, smoking is not a good thing. Alcoholism. We see a lot of high blood pressure, headaches, those types of things. So it's really important that they learn how to relax, how to reduce that stress. So I do a lot of stress reduction techniques. I help them understand that they can ground themselves in the present time. They need to stay in the present time as much as possible, because when they start going off in their minds and they start remembering and they're triggered, then that activates their whole system. Their whole system fills full of adrenaline, and that does some difficult things for the body. In terms of behaviors, we'll find that they can't follow through with tasks. They get confused. They get frustrated with themselves. They may feel overprotective of their loved ones. The veterans who come home from war, probably every single one of you who are sitting in this room today, know that the world is a dangerous place. That's the reality. But us who don't go to war, who stay home, just go about our daily chores, live in a little bubble, we don't even think of that. But the veterans know it in a different way. And so they come home and they're very protective of their loved ones. They know how fragile life is and how easily it can be lost. And they don't want to lose again. And that's one of the reasons they freeze their hearts, is they don't want to feel that they're going to lose again. They've lost so much to begin with. And so they may be overprotective, what we think overprotective with their loved ones, but for them, they're doing what they're trained to do. They're protecting the ones that they love. Needs for weapons, that's an interesting thing. Their weapons are their best friend over there. Oftentimes, they go everywhere with them. They go to the shower, they go to the bathroom, they sleep with them. They're never without their weapons. And so when they come home, first thing their wives want them to do is get rid of their weapons. Well, they might as well put them out on the freeway stark naked with the spotlight on them, because they feel very, very vulnerable without their weapons. But the bottom line is, too, the safety of those they live with and how well, that person who's coming home can handle their emotions. Because if they're at risk of harming someone else or themselves, then we need to find a way to take their weapons away for a while, and maybe eventually they can have them back. So safety is very, very important. But I have one young man that I work with, and his wife had all his weapons taken out of the house. This was very difficult for him. And so finally, she let him have them back. And what he loves doing is he loves taking apart his weapon, cleaning it, polishing it, putting it back together. He loves filling the bullets. You know, this is a ritual. This is relaxing. For him, this is relaxing. He's not going to go out and fire it. It's just relaxing. So these are really interesting little cultural, because the military is a culture of itself, a subculture, little cultural things that we don't realize as civilians. One of the other things is stupid people, quote, stupid people doing stupid things, really upsetting to them. They come back in to the workforce. They see civilians wasting their time, not making effective decisions, putting other people at risk by some of the decisions that they do make, and it absolutely flips them out. Because I always think of military training, it's like a transparency or a schematic or something. And let's take that transparency and we put it into civilian life, and it doesn't fit very well. Because they don't have tolerance for that. I mean, in the military, they're trained that everything, even though there's a lot of time that they have to, they have a lot of boredom too. I've heard this. But there's times when they are working that everything has to be exact and precise. They can't afford to make mistakes. They can't afford to have someone watching their back that's going to make mistakes. Because the mistakes are grave. It means someone's going to lose their life or get very severely wounded. So when they come back into the workforce, it's very difficult for them just to have a lackadaisical attitude. So they have a difficult time accepting the fact that some people don't take their jobs very seriously. So that's one of the reasons they have so many turnovers in their jobs. They work better by themselves oftentimes and away from other people. But these are just things for those of you in the workforce that are out there, maybe to realize, oh, this guy just got home, or this guy's a Vietnam vet. Maybe I need to, you know, be a little bit more tolerant of that person. Isolation and avoidance, of course, that's one of the diagnostic criteria for PTSD, but it's also a way of them charging their batteries, recharging their batteries. It's not always so bad to isolate or avoid social situations if you know you're going to have a reaction to something. So it's part of taking care of yourself. I have a Korean War veteran that was blown off the front of a ship and left for hours, and he had PTSD. He didn't know he had PTSD till he came to see me. He was really a neat little guy. And he said, all these years, I didn't know why I was doing this, but when I would go out with my wife or go to someone's house, I would always excuse myself and go to the men's room. And I would just kind of sit in there for a while, because he would get so activated, he'd get so angry and riled up, and he didn't want to cause problems, so he would just excuse himself, and nobody would follow him into the bathroom, and he'd just sit in there for a few minutes and just chill down. And I thought that was such a great way of trying to take care of himself. So I always share that story. So the homicidal thoughts, sometimes the anger, rage, or suicidal thoughts, we really need to pay attention to. And sometimes they need to go into the hospital for a while just to take a hiatus, just to relax and maybe get their medications taken care of. And Scott's going to talk about more treatment. I'm more or less talking about the things that I see in my practice and things that I hear the guys are doing. We did a study, the Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs. We go around to the armories around the state and do intakes on National Guard's soldiers who have come home from Iraq. And out of 2,000 of the National Guard soldiers that were interviewed, we found that 43% of them had readjustment issues. That's different than what we're hearing out there. So 43%, and this is just a little snippet of a sampling, and that was right after they came home. So we know that the numbers are probably going to be much more high than that, much higher than that. 5,000 to 8,000 school-age children are going to be affected by this deployment. Nationally, the overall rate of PTSD has been described at 30%, but I think those are conservative numbers. 25 to 40% of those with PTSD recover within the first year of after trauma. I don't know where these statistics come from, but they're put into from a reliable source who's very very much an advocate for veterans. So the treatment is very, very important. 30 to 50% of those with PTSD do not recover even after many years. So one of my vets said, you know, I have PTSD, but it doesn't have me. And I like that saying because it empowers someone. It makes them feel that they have choices. You know, everything, there's a consequence to every choice we make. And if we can work with our veterans and families and help them find different alternatives to ending up incarcerated or ending up on the streets with a drug or alcohol problem, you know, that's a very important thing. There's so many Vietnam veterans right now who are incarcerated because they were doing what they were trained to do. They were out, they got into a fight, or maybe they were using alcohol. So we're hoping that not to happen as much with this group of veterans. So we're looking at all the ways that the families are affected. The other thing is that's unique to this war, too, is that it's a, like, you get emails and you get cell phones. I have wives that have been holding the cell phones, and their husbands say, oh, my gosh, we just got mortared. I got to go. Well, she's held holding this. What's she going to do with this? Freak out. I mean, she doesn't know what to do with this. So there's vicarious traumatization, secondary traumatization that families also experience because they don't know what to do with all these emotions. I know that the family readiness groups are there, you know, to support the wives and all that, but so oftentimes the wives don't share a lot of this either because they don't want to think something's wrong with them. But so that's something that's different. That's the downside to the communication. Instantaneous communication. The other side is, of course, that they do hear from their loved ones, and that helps quite a bit with the adjustment. So we have to realize, I guess, in closing, that there are just—I mean, I could go on for hours—and everyone is affected. The veterans affected. The families are affected. The children are affected. The communities are affected. The mental health workers are affected. We're all affected by what we have coming home, and we all have a lot of work to do, and we all need to join together to be able to bring our troops home as close to home as we can get them. So I will be available for book signings after this and questions and answers, and thank you very much for asking me to be here today.
Okay, hopefully we can get the PowerPoint to fire up here for us. We'll see if it comes up. We might have some problems with that. My name is Dr. Scott Michael. I'm a psychologist here at the VA healthcare system here in Seattle. I work in the post-traumatic stress disorder clinic. My goal today is to talk about the psychotherapeutic approaches and to take some of what Dr. Cantrell talked with you about in terms of identifying some of the thoughts and behaviors that are really a large part of what we see in combat stress reactions, and talk about what do we do about that? What do we do when people come in through the door? I wanted to give you an idea for what happens at our clinic, and maybe as a model for what we're doing VA-wide when somebody comes to us with some difficulties. One of the things I wanted to have as a model from the get-go is, you know, what do we do when we talk about treatment? How do we treat the human system? You know, one of the ways to think about the human system is, you know, we have our physiology, right, our neuroanatomy, our neurochemicals, what's happening in our brain, what's happening in our bodies in terms of our stress and adrenaline system. We have our thoughts, our emotions, and behaviors. And really, what we find is that the best approaches are a comprehensive approach that addresses many areas of the system. And a change in one area of the system can radiate out into the other areas of the system. So a good example of this is if somebody comes in to see us and they're feeling pretty depressed, their energy is really low, the way that we think of an antidepressant medication working is that it gets in there and affects the neurochemistry, but then that catalyzes changes out throughout the whole system. So maybe the person feels energetic enough now to get out there and start doing some new stuff, kind of get re-engaged with their life, start doing family activities, start going to classes, take a dance class. You know, these are new behaviors they're doing, and that might affect their thoughts. They're saying, hey, you know, I'm getting better. I'm feeling good about what I'm doing, feel more confident about my life. So the thoughts change too. So you can kind of see how changes in one area can radiate out. I'm a psychologist, so I deal with the psychotherapy portion, and really where I do a lot of my work is in the thoughts and the behaviors. And there can be changes that way, too. We actually have some nifty neuroimaging studies these days that show that changes in thoughts and behaviors actually do lead to changes in neurochemistry as well. So our idea at the VA is, let's give somebody a comprehensive package if they're amenable to it. Let's do some psychotherapy. Let's get them exercising and affect their physiology that way. If they're interested in medications, let's have them take some medications. My area of specialty is the thoughts and the behavior, so I'm going to speak specifically to that area today. So I'm going to jump forward into the type of treatment that I do, which is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And Bridget hit some of this stuff really well. This we start off with a model from the get-go when I talk with patients who come to my office about what is PTSD and how do we understand it. And the way that we really understand PTSD is it's a survival adaptation. What I like to tell guys is it's a sane reaction to insane circumstances. War's a pretty insane place. It's a dangerous place. It's a chaotic place. You have to make certain adaptations to stay alive or you're going to die. And so are the guys in your unit. And so you learn pretty quickly. The training begins to help catalyze those changes, but you learn really quickly when you're in a war zone how to adapt. It's a life or death proposition. And those adaptations are very, very useful adaptations in a war zone. What we think about happens in PTSD is that people bring those reactions home with them. Some people adapt within a pretty short order. They learn how to say to themselves, okay, that really worked for me in a war zone. It's not working for me here. What we find is that people who have an ongoing issue tend to apply the same kinds of war zone ways of operating again and again and again in their civilian life, and it starts to really get in the way. So what's adaptive for a war zone is not always adaptive for home. Okay? That's not always true. There are certain things that people learn in a war zone that can be very helpful back home. But if you continue to use the same war zone patterns of thinking, behaving, and feeling, after a while it's going to lead to some difficulties. And I'll give some examples of that in a bit. So what cognitive behavioral therapy does is it helps somebody recognize their thoughts and behaviors from the war zone and step back for a second, sort through that and say, okay, is that working for me? That's something that I ask a lot of the guys I work with. How's that working for you? Is it working? Great. How is it not working? Where is it getting in the way? What might help you better? Okay. And some of the terminology that's being used these days is the terminology of battle mind thinking versus home zone thinking. I take this from Dr. Charles Hoag. He's a psychiatrist at Walter Reed and has done a lot of the really good research in this area. And they have a training that they're doing for returnees who are coming through Walter Reed called battle mind training, recognizing the elements of battle mind thinking that you're applying to your home front life. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. How do you help people recognize their thinking and how it changed? Okay, there are some really core perceptions that many of us have growing up in the world that get changed as a result of going to war zone. So you can see I kind of put the not or the don't there. So oftentimes many of us might come up in a childhood in a place where the world is a safe place. You know, that's not true for all of us. Some people grew up in some pretty hard scrabble lives, but for the most part, many of us see the world as a safe place, and you learn pretty quickly in a war zone that that's not the case. You might grow up believing people are basically trustworthy. You know, you can count on a lot of people. You learn pretty quickly to be very careful who you trust in a war zone. I mean, they've got your life and the life of other people on the line. They better be right there with everything wired tight, okay? And finally, this idea, good things happen to good people. You know, and that really gets changed as a result of being in a war zone. You see some really good people who have some bad things happen to them. You know, the world is not such a fair place, is some of what people learn as a result of being in a war zone. And this can really, this makes a lot of sense in the context, right? So battle mind makes sense. You have to make certain adaptations in your thinking and behavior. But what tends to happen is battle mind thinking can exaggerate certain things when people get home. So here's an example of this. Many of the guys I work with feel very uncomfortable in marketplaces, Seattle Center, the shopping mall. They absolutely hate the shopping mall, okay? Well, what's going on in the shopping mall, right? It's really hard to maintain your perimeter. There's a lot of different people that they're scanning constantly for the potential for danger. But here's sort of the exaggeration. What's the probability of getting attacked in a marketplace in Iraq? Very high. When was the last time you heard of somebody getting attacked in a supermarket in America? Okay, if you think 290 million Americans, we probably make 4 billion supermarket visits a year. Okay, even if 1,000 attacks happen a year in supermarkets, which is maybe even pretty high, your chance of getting attacked in a supermarket in America are probably 0.1%. And yet, the people that I work with feel extremely uncomfortable in the marketplace, okay, like a supermarket. And they feel most uncomfortable, for instance, in the checkout line. People behind, people in front of you, your exits are too far away, you're trapped, okay? It's good never to be trapped, never to get pinned in a war zone. In many places in America, that may not actually be an incredibly threatening thing to have happen. And yet people their nervous systems are acting as if they're back in a war zone during those times. So let me hit some of these areas of battle mind thinking. I won't read through all of these. I think you could take a look at this. And many of you who yourselves are veterans, I'm sure, develop very similar thinking patterns as a result of being in your service in the military. You know, whether you're in a war zone or not, the military is a very dangerous place to be. That's what the military is about. You train at a very high level. You have a very high precision of operation capacity that you learn, and very small mistakes get you or other people hurt. Now, this thinking is a very adaptive, again, in the battle zone, but can get in the way when people get back home. Okay, I'll give a good example of this. You know, working with a patient who found himself yelling at one of his children because he left a sweater at school. And he said, you never leave your equipment behind. And he was yelling to his 7-year-old. You know, and he realized, leaving your equipment behind is, in a war zone is very dangerous. And yes, it's really good to train your kids to be responsible, but a 7-year-old doesn't quite get that. There are probably other ways rather than yelling how you can talk to your kid to impart responsibility without going overboard. But these are very strong ideas that come up time and again. You know, Bridget hit this well, incompetence kills. This is a biggie for anger in the workplace with returning veterans. Okay, incompetence in the military gets people killed. And that can happen in the workplace here. You know, but I had a guy who his tools were all set up in a specific way. That's great. You know, if you need to grab a tool on a moment's notice, it's got to be there. But a lot of times in America today, like where you're going to grab a tool, it's not a life or death proposition if that tool is there. Some people work in like high risk construction, but many people don't. And yelling at somebody that they misplaced the tools is not going to be very helpful in getting along in the workplace. So what we talk about is recognizing these elements of battle mind thinking that are helpful and those that are not helpful. How can you step back and sort those through and figure out what's the best of that to keep and what's the best to be aware of and maybe discard? There are other elements as well in stateside thinking that can lead to some issues here. So when many people come home from a war zone, some of these thoughts are very, very common and prominent. What you can see about many of these issues is that, they boil down to, I can't relate to other people. Civilians really aren't going to understand where I'm coming from, and what happened there stays there. That makes it very difficult. There's this very strong part of this identity that many people have as part of their military service that they feel like they have to close off and can never share with anybody. And it makes it very difficult sometimes, for instance, to relate to a wife. And she may not understand a reaction that her husband is having, and he feels like, well, I can't tell her what's going on right now because if I did, she's going to think there's something really wrong with me, you know? So a good example of this, July 4th, is an awful time for lots of folks who've been in a war zone. Well, instead of saying, hey, the fireworks really rev up my nervous system, a lot of guys don't want to talk about it. They avoid the family get-together, they turn up the sound on the TV, maybe they drink as a way to kind of control the nervous system. But people don't understand, why are you isolating from the family? These are the very things that we work with our patients. Can you talk about that? Say, this is why I'm having this problem. My nervous system still believes it's back in a war zone. So how do you change it? Okay. Well, the first thing is to help somebody realize when their battle mind is snapping into place. This stuff is incredibly automatic, right? It has to be, just like Bridget Hitt was talking about. Something happens, boom. It's thinking without thinking, right? The response is so automatic, somebody is going into action gear on a moment's notice. Okay? But many times people then carry that through. And so sometimes we talk about, some people say, well, I hear that PTSD isn't curable. What does that mean? Well, one of the things we think about is that the nervous system has some changes that have happened, right? So, for instance, a car backfire may always set off a nervous system response, but then what somebody does with that is a different story. Work with a lot of guys with road rage issues, right? Somebody swerving in front of you is dangerous. That, it's great that your nervous system jumps into gear and gets you ready for that. But when that turns into anger and trying to forcibly pull someone over, to the side of the road, it's no longer about safety, is it? That actually vastly elevates the potential for threat or danger by trying to pull someone over. So that person may always have a nervous system response to being cut off in traffic, but then what they do with that is where I think treatment can be very helpful. One of the issues here is that quick black or white decisions equal survival. This is one of the great ways the military works, and with the command structure too. Things have to happen like that. It's black or white, it's 0-100%, it's all or nothing. Okay? All or nothing thinking works very well in keeping you alive. This drives some of the guys I work with batty when the civilian world is a world of grays. And a lot of guys will say to me, like, well, if the workplace just operated like the military, the world would be a better place. We'd get a lot more done. I got no qualms with that. It's probably true. However, unless you have your own business, you kind of can't always make it run like the military. And sometimes you've got to compromise if you want to get along. One of the issues here is that the thinking brain is right here and the emotional brain is right here, and the emotional brain is what guides a lot of these very quick reactions. It's really good like that. The emotional brain is right here, the stimulus comes in, and boom, somebody's off and acting. Oftentimes what's not happening is the thinking brain right up here, the old cortex, is not talking to the emotional brain. This is one of the ways I frame it to the guys I work with. We've got to get these two areas of the brain talking together. You know, getting cut off in traffic and then immediately trying to pull someone off the road or getting up on their rear and flashing lights is not so helpful. It feels good for a second. It's an adrenaline burst to do that. It gives a little juice to the system, but it doesn't really improve safety or one's health and well-being in the long run. Okay? So then helping somebody sort through what are the best elements of your battle mind thinking, how can you retain that without letting it rule your life? And it's really important to reinforce the survival value. That thinking will always be there. And that's one of the issues. The survival value of that is always there. It's always there to be used. But if you use it in all circumstances across all areas of your life, it's usually going to lead to some problems. It usually gets in the way of some important life goals. So here's an example of this. I had a patient I was working with whose son is a high school wrestler. He had an incredibly difficult time going to the wrestling matches because there's so much stimulus happening, right? It's like a gym. There's lots of yelling and screaming. There's a lot of people in the bleachers. And he would get very upset. He could feel really uncomfortable. And he went to, like, the first match of his son's wrestling career, felt really worked up, got out of the wrestling arena, felt better, and didn't go to subsequent ones. So on the one hand, his nervous system was saying, get out of here, this is too much to manage. But on the other side, he had this important value in his life, which is, I want to be a part of my son's life. I want to be there for his wrestling matches. That's a great target for treatment right there. Because that's an important life value or life goal that is now being impeded as a result of the way that his nervous system reacts. So working on recognizing, okay, is it truly such a dangerous place, wrestling gym? You know, how often do people get really attacked in wrestling gyms? Are there ways that you can manage your distress in another way, like with some good stress management skills, some relaxation, to bring down the jitteriness and the jangliness of what's happening to his nerves at that time? This leads to some of the elements of behavior therapy. Okay, I've talked about the cognitive therapy, which is the thought therapy, helping people recognize their thoughts. But then the next one is the behavior therapy, and what I think about this is helping somebody get back into their life. Because unfortunately what happens is that when people come home, they're initially very worked up. And they start to avoid some activities as a way of managing what's happening. Okay, so the family gatherings get very uncomfortable, so they back out of a family gathering, right? Bridget gave this great example. The cookout started to stir up a lot of thoughts and memories. Somebody doesn't want to go to the cookout, so they don't. And they feel a little bit better because they didn't go to the cookout. It makes the next cookout that much more difficult. And the one after that, and the one after that. And this person's life is kind of shrinking. They're not engaging in the things that were really important to them before as a way of really trying to manage what's happening. Okay? And so what you see is these avoidance patterns start to take root. And it really starts to affect what's important to a person's life. And there's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy of avoidance, right? So I got anxious when I went to the wrestling arena. I got out of there. Nothing bad happened to me. Therefore, it was the right choice. It was good for me to get out of there because I avoided something dangerous. What happens is the person never gets a chance. If they go to the wrestling arena again and again, and they realize that nothing really bad happens, it starts to retrain the nervous system over time. So helping somebody get back into their life, and it kind of helps rewire that response in a way. See, what unfortunately happens is that in the short term, avoidance really helps to manage distress and anxiety. You know, family gathering, you get there, you feel pretty nervous, you walk out to go take a smoke, you feel better. Okay, but maybe I'm just going to go take a walk around the block, I feel even better. And then after that, I feel even better still. Okay, so why even bother going to the next one and the next one? So in the short term, yes, manages anxiety. In the long term, what happens though? These situations go on triggering discomfort, and it becomes harder and harder for people to get back into their life. So this is really why I see one of the issues of the avoidance, the isolation, the emotional numbing as being one of the real problems in the chronicity of this disorder. Why people go from having short-term problems to having very long-term problems. An example, Evan brought up driving being a really big deal. Driving is where a lot of trauma happens in Iraq. And people do a lot of their missions in Humvees or some kind of vehicles. And they adapt certain ways of acting and behaving in vehicles that then they then carry home with them. So, for instance, it's very common to do a lot of like pre-combat inspections around an automobile, make sure that all the fluids are there, nothing's been sniffed, there's been no sabotage. You never let anyone pull in front of you. Okay, there could be a false bottom where someone's going to drop an explosive device through the false bottom of their car. So don't let anyone pull in front of you. So aggressively push cars away. They shouldn't be within a certain distance to you. Never get pinned in. Always have an exit. Always know exactly where you're going and never go someplace where you get trapped. And never get caught on the road at night. I mean, these are some very common issues that start to raise problems. I had a guy I was working with who went to go pick up his kids at school and got kind of trapped in when he was picking them up. And he immediately he yelled at them, "Come on, come on, come on." They got in the car and he drove over the median and screamed out of the parking lot. He was pinned in. That's a bad thing in a vehicle in Iraq. High school parking lot is probably not so dangerous, but his emotional brain didn't understand that. So this is what behavioral therapy, in a sense, is having somebody do the opposite. Okay? So practice these things. Don't do the combat inspections. Let people pull in front of you. Drive slower. Don't swerve to avoid boxes on the side of the street. This starts to rewire the nervous system over time. The nervous system starts to learn, well, boxes don't always equal danger. There has to be kind of a rewiring that happens as people behave differently. So this kind of leads to this idea of what path do you take? Okay, and guys are faced with a decision here. Do I re-engage with my life, or do I continue down this same pathway of avoiding things? In the short term, on a day-to-day basis, it makes sense. Well, I'm just going to avoid something that makes me feel uncomfortable. In the long run, what happens is that you start to get a person's life shrinking up. So it starts way out here where people's sphere of life is like this, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and it gets that much tougher. And this is where depression really comes in and PTSD. You're kind of in this tight little sphere, bunkered down with very little activity, and you get really depressed. It's a bummer, to put it very mildly. So what we do with treatment, in a sense, with one kind of treatment called behavioral activation, is we help people push out the spheres. Try a little bit today. So for instance, okay, great, go to your son's wrestling match. This guy, he wanted to get really geared up because his son had the wrestling finals coming up at the Tacoma Dome. Big one. Right, Tacoma Dome, you could imagine. So start by going to your son's wrestling tournaments in the small gyms, get more and more comfortable so you could be ready for the Tacoma Dome. Because that was really important to be at the son's finals. So part of what this approach talks about in behavioral activation is helping somebody realize what the function that avoidance serves. Right? Function, avoidance and numbing serves a great function in a war zone. Shut everything down, avoid danger, avoid the dangerous emotions inside by numbing yourself so you can be fully operational. But what happens in the home front is that this oftentimes leads to a lot of avoidance, especially in relationships. So, you know, the sadness, for instance, is something you can't afford to feel in a war zone. You shove it over here, I'll deal with it later. People never get a chance to deal with it later. And now, if it comes up in the context of a relationship, they're really shut down. And, for instance, a wife might be saying, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you feeling? Okay, that's a survival response that somebody needs to work through. But very often what happens is people start to bunker up more and more, and they avoid more. They go stay in their shop, their garage, and they start to avoid the family, and things get pretty bad. And I've got to say to me, well, you know, I feel pretty good in my bunker. You know, I feel happy. And I say to him, is it that you feel happy, or is it just that you don't feel uncomfortable? And that's where a lot of the pleasure of life gets zapped as a result of PTSD. People aren't out there doing the kinds of things that would make them feel really good, make them feel like they're leading a satisfying, meaningful, rewarding life. So I'll kind of leave it with there. What we do, in a sense, then, is help somebody pick really valued life activities. Pick goals. What's meaningful to you? Great. Let's get you out there doing that. So, for instance, a guy, you know, guys may feel really uncomfortable going to a Seahawks game, but if he doesn't care if he's going to the Seahawks game, I don't have an interest in getting him to go to the Seahawks game. Alternatively, he wants to go to his son's baseball game or his daughter's soccer game. Great. That's important to you? Then let's work on that one. Because, you know, you help somebody choose important life actions. So it becomes, in this case, your values become the guide for your behavior, not your feelings. Very often it's like, well, I don't feel good when I'm there, so therefore I won't do it. That's not going to get me. That doesn't just change on its own. You kind of have to make steps to get out of there. Choose something that's important to you. Start acting and knowing that you'll start to feel better once you do it more and more often. So sometimes I frame it like, okay, well, we know that it's going to take 10 times before you feel comfortable going to your daughter's soccer game. Great. Get the first 9 out of the way as soon as we can. Let's get to the 10th so we can get to the gravy. Let's get to the good stuff again. It's a struggle, and one of the things, you know, I'm constantly struck by how hard the guys I work with want to work and do want to get better, and just what a struggle it is, you know, and it's a really fantastic thing to see them take these steps forward and get back into their lives, you know, because at the end of the day, what PTSD is really about, this is the central struggle of PTSD, it's surviving versus thriving. PTSD gets people into surviving, and they're missing out on all the thriving. They're missing out on the good stuff. And that's I say that, okay, what's the good stuff? Let's get you back in there. So thanks. I appreciate it.
I'm the son of a World War I veteran who was a disabled vet. And he was 60 years in the VA system. Now I'm 60 years in the VA system. And so the PTSD, which of course is a new name for whatever veterans suffer, he suffered. He was gassed during the war, and he was a wonderful father, but he was also a bastard. Mm-hmm. But he didn't know when he was going to be a bastard and when he wasn't going to be a bastard. Mm-hmm. So when I went into the Navy in World War II, I was already a victim of PTSD. Mm-hmm. So I brought that in, pre-existing condition, the doctor would say. I came in with a pre-existing condition. And so I went on, and I ended up the same thing. Well, I ended up with PTSD, only they didn't call it that. Mm-hmm. So then later on in life, I had something else happen to me, and I ended up going to the PTSD at the hospital up here. And so I experienced all of what goes on in the sessions. And my question to you is this. What I want to try to do, my mission right now, is to not have any more veterans become disabled veterans. My question to you, kind of, and I didn't hear you talk about the suicide aspect mm-hmm. of it. And these veterans, I've known these guys. Yeah. And they're dead now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was one thing to have the guy die at 19 in World War II, but another thing to have an adult vet that came back. And the next thing you know, he's gone because he's circled down. You know, his immune system went down and down and down. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, he's got the gun out and bang. So mm-hmm. I want you to try to do the best you can to tell me what you're going to try to do to not have that happen.
That's a huge thing. There's already several suicides that are happening over there in the field. And we're not talking about that here. I hear about it. I hear about it from the guys that are coming home. I hear about it when I get calls in the middle of the night. They all have my cell phones. All my Iraqi vets have my cell phone. And they know they can call me any time, day or night. And I hear about it in the middle of the night. And it is a big thing. And we can sit up here and we can say that we have treatment for this, that, and the other. But the fact is that the suicides are going to be happening, unfortunately. And all I can say is I hope that by being more accessible to my veterans and knowing that I can pick up the phone anytime and speak to them, or they can go and get treatment from other people in the community, is something that's going to make a difference in their lives. And also to hook them up with other veterans, like I said I did, trying to hook them up with other veterans that have walked before them. And one of the things in our community, we don't have the rituals here that other cultures do to welcome our warriors home. So oftentimes they're kept with all of this internally, and they're not revered for having been a warrior. I mean, they are warriors. And so hopefully we as a community can do things to facilitate the fact that they need to come home and feel some kind of pride for having been a person in the military that have done their job. Their job wasn't pretty, but they did it, and they came home. And so I don't know the answer to that. I just know realistically, because I'm not going to put sugar on anything, it's going to happen, and it's happening as we sit here. And we just have to be accessible. I think that's the main thing, being accessible.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add one thing quickly. Perhaps the biggest problem we have right now is getting people to come in for help. And all of the studies from Walter Reed and elsewhere have shown that the majority of the people who are demonstrating symptoms and are having problems are not seeking help. Young men particularly don't want to come in to see a doctor for any reason. And so that's one of our biggest struggles. And so if you know Iraq vets and you can encourage them to seek help, that's one of the most important things.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm wondering if you can speak to the physiological effects of long-term PTSD. I'm particularly wondering about if your adrenaline is coursing through your system for years, doesn't your adrenals break down, and is your thyroid affected, and what other systems are to be watched?
Let's get that data.
Yeah, here.
You're the expert.
I mean, I've talked about it
for years. It pretty much ravages the body. We know that your adrenaline system is tuned up a couple notches too high all the time. And essentially what happens is that your reaction time is better, but your memory and your concentration are much worse. And those are the fundamental long-term problems. The thyroid axis is affected. The adrenal stress hormones are affected. And there are effects beyond that on the heart and on the immune system, so that people with PTSD seem to be more susceptible to heart disease and diabetes. It's been demonstrated, just totally aside from PTSD, World War II veterans who were in combat have worse health by a significant margin than those who are not exposed to combat. So that's probably all the detail I can give you for now, but there's a long list of physiological changes that we can now measure.
We're at time, I guess.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I'm sorry. We just got the time from the back. Thank you.